Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of November 2018. Welcome to episode 42 of this podcast. The concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time I did one of these episodes, which should make this pretty much the books that I read during November. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost the links to those on my Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those, but those posts are not spoilers for this podcast, since those are just lists. And here, you have a little more review, a little more critique, and a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback. I heard from Dr. Ange on the book Kill or Be Killed, which won for favorite read of the month 2 months in a row. That is a great book. Definitely need to read it through. Agreed on both counts, Doctor. Sir Martin of Grey schooled me on the concept of being inside the magic lasso, which was done in a recent Wonder Woman issue, and that was the first time that I had seen that. But he said that it was done first in the Gail Simone run. He also had more general comments on the WW title. I enjoyed the first story by Steve Orlando, but the rest, not so much. Has there ever been a good Bonnie Migdal story? I've hated them ever since I first saw the unpronounceable, tough-to-spell name. George Perez could have called them the African Amazons, or the Grumpy Amazons, but oh no, not realistic enough. It's a wonder we escaped with an annoying extra apostrophe. See? Count your small blessings, Sir Martin. And from Sir Iowa's Joe. I think if you can't remember who sent the books, I'll take the credit. The Love and Rockets was definitely for me, as was the Micronauts annual a few months ago. Less Ben and Sue bashing in this episode so far. I guess I'll enjoy it while I can. I'm sure that won't last. This is actually not a bad principle at all, and also a pretty good campaign slogan. If I don't know, it's Iowa's Joe. Retweets and likes and shares for that last episode came from Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, Nathaniel Wayne of the Council of Geeks, Gene, the podcasting machine Hendrix from Two True Freaks, Big Easy 77, Ed Moore from Teal Productions, The Sutherlands from Trekker Talk, Warlord Worlds, and other shows on the Rad Adventure Network, Christopher Willette from Bizarre Manor, Luke Giaconetti from the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, Mike Carlisle from the Crap Box of the Son of Cthulhu blog, Chris from Bat Books for Beginners, Pat Sampson from the Long Box Crusade, Paul Matthew Carr from the Collected Edition, and Laurel at Mountainflower1 from the Feathers and Foes podcast. Thanks for all that awesome and encouraging feedback and social media love. Very appreciated. And on to the books that I read last month. And we're starting with a book that I read with a heavy heart, which happened to be my book in process when I heard of the passing of Stan Lee. Because even though Mr. Lee did not write Silver Surfer 107, he did co-create the title character and the lead guest star, one Dr. Doom. It's actually a Doombot, but that is a minor quibble. And dealing with this specific issue is not all that important, actually. I do want to mention Doom here because, of course, in honor of Mr. Lee's passing, all Latverian consulates were closed for the week with the Marvel Comics flag flying at half-staff. Because despite all the quibbles that we pod people have, that's People of Doom, all the quibbles that we have with big comics and their hashtag fake continuity, of all the translators of Doom's noble acts from the grand Latverian epics and English language comics, Mr. Lee was the best. I have a feeling he may have even embellished those tales of glory a little bit. And of all the comic stories I've ever had the pleasure of reading, one of the best, maybe the best, is the lead story in Fantastic Four Annual No. 2. You can tell it's special because I can say those two F words, fantastic and four, without spitting. The lead story, The Origin of Dr. Doom by Jack Kirby and Stan Lee, is comic storytelling at its best. And its doomiest, which is another way of saying best. And I will in no way presume to speak for Mr. Stanley Lieber, but I am comfortable in saying that he would want us at this point to continue reading and talking about comic books. So let's do that. And we start with the books that I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books. And for Quarterman 127, I read Marvel Team-Up 65, the U.S. debut of Captain Britain. Spoilers, but he and Spidey fight. I know. I, too, was shocked by that development. And I read one book for listening to a podcast, because following along with podcasts is always a fun thing to do. And over on Justice's First Dawn, Mike Peacock recently covered a three-part storyline, a Justice League, Justice Society, New Gods crossover, and I happen to have the first part of that, courtesy of Mark Sweeney. So I read Justice League of America 183. And on to the new comics that we read right off the shelves. Most of these, but not all, are DC Universe titles, and we will start with those. Adventures of the Super Sons, number 4, the cliff-hanging surprise at the end of last issue was the surprise appearance of, I'm not kidding here, Space Cabbie. That was Joker Jr.'s way to rescue the three Super Sons. Three, because we started the issue with both Superboy Red and Superboy Blue. But they managed to get put back together, even though that's kind of a mystery as to how. And there's also a mystery of the planet they've landed on and the strange mansion that's on that planet and the strange beings that grab them all at the end of the issue. Wonder Woman and Justice League Dark, The Witching Hour, number 1. I read the books in this series wildly out of order, but I think it says something about the way James Tynion IV wrote this series that didn't make all that much difference. I just took this one as a prequel to what I'd read before, and it worked. I like that the magic heroes and the non-magic heroes don't have a 100% trusting and open relationship again. I think that makes sense. And now that Wonder Woman has had some dark magic added to her, she finds herself a woman without a home, without a team. Oh, and Zatanna and John Constantine smooch. So that was an added bonus. Wonder Woman, 57 and 58. 57 was the penultimate chapter, if I'm reading things correctly, of the Witching Hour event, which I, again, thoroughly enjoyed, even though I read just a little more than half of it. In this one, a severely injured John Constantine is talked by Zatanna into one more exorcism as a way of removing the witch entity from inside Wonder Woman. But seeing as it is Constantine we're talking about, it doesn't quite go as planned. G. Willow Wilson picked up the writing duties after the crossover, starting with issue 58. And we get the start of her first story, which, it appears, will put Wonder Woman against one of her most famous villains. But before that reveal on the last page, we get her standing up to Edda to ignore her commands to not invade Dorovnia to save Steve Trevor. I do love that in this most modern Wonder Woman run, with a pretty modern version of the lead character, we still get Steve Trevor in his classic role of dude in distress. And from the good folks at Alterna, the home of newsprint comics, comes an issue at even a cheaper price than the regular $150, the Baron Rat $1 one-shot. Baron Rat is a side character in the Mr. Crypt books, and he's a rat. when he sees that a cheese festival is coming to town. Baron Rat decides that he needs to visit so as to abscond with as much cheese as possible. This is one of the most fun current comics I've read in a long time. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but it was kind of worth the $1 price. Also, from Alterna, we get a new miniseries starting at their regular, still pretty awesome price of $1.50, Midnight Mystery, number one. Bernie Gonzalez wrote and drew this issue, in which we find Detective Zeke King, who specializes in strange cases. In this one, he's hired to find the lost son of a deceased horror host. That part is easy. But when he and the son go visit the mansion that the son has inherited, things go weirdly. And from the teeny tiny Benitez Publications, I read a miniseries that I purchased over the course of the last number of months, but I was saving it to read it all at once. And it's the latest mini featuring one of my favorite characters in comics. Lady Mechanica, La Belle Dame Sans Merci, 1-3. A word-for-word translation of that French subtitle would probably be something along the lines of The Beautiful Woman Without Mercy, although I would go with something more pithy like The Merciless Beauty. This is the story that was teased in this year's Free Comic Book Day, in which Mechanica discovers an arm very similar to her own, and investigating that becomes a priority as it might reveal secrets about her own mysterious mechanical origins. Now, I love the steampunk aesthetic, and this series does it about as good as anyone. What I like is that they are very true to the Victorian age, with manners and expectations and social situations that seem to this 21st century man to be period correct. Except for the mechanical ladies and all the steampunk stuff. I mean, other than that, it seemed period correct. I like the way that this moved along, answering a few questions, asking a few more. New Lady Mechanica stories don't come along all that often, and I certainly hope that 2019 may bring us another installment, because I thoroughly enjoyed this one. And although it's not really a comic, but more of an advertisement for comics, I did pick it up because it was free, and that is DC Nation number 6. The focus was on the return of Hal Jordan in the upcoming Green Lantern series by Grant Morrison and Liam Sharp. There was an interesting bit on the roles played by the penciler, inker, and colorist in the design process, and also a nice discussion of the upcoming Wonderline, the new series of titles curated by Brian Michael Bendis, which will include a new take on a title that is a relatively geeky favorite, Dial H for Hero. And on to the general comic reading that I did. We gave a shout out last month to our most recent inductee to the hashtag comic book circle of life, and that's Dr. Anthony the Engineer. He sent a nice care package recently, and I read some of these books in November. The Lost City Explorers 1 and 2. This is from Aftershock, from all the way back in early 2018. I think the series just wrapped up its first arc with issue 5. We have a mad professor, what other kind is there, who disappeared during an attempt at contacting ancient Atlantis. The evil organization that he works for is covering this up, but his kids don't buy it. It's a pretty great setup for a series, and these first two issues were quite strong. I hear that there is a TV adaptation of The Lost City Explorers in the works, and I can see that. There's even sort of a TV feel to these issues, with a few pages of cold open, then literally a two-page spread that is just the title card, and then the rest of the story. It's a weird way to present a comic book, but a pretty typical way to present a TV story. Dr. Anthony also sent one of the strangest books I've read in a while from Hero Tomorrow Comics, The Tap Dance Killer, number 1. Through a supernatural act, a theater troupe gains powers and goes on a crime spree, and our lead character becomes the Tap Dance Killer. She escapes prison, and that is when things get weird. It's an intriguing idea, I think, but also a very strange book. And from the dollar bins at World's Greatest Comics, but when they were on sale for three for a dollar, I picked up a book that if I'd flipped through it at all, I would have read last month. Howard the Duck, number 6, because this one had a creepy Victorian mansion, creepy people inhabiting a creepy Victorian mansion, and a whole bunch of weird characters. It would have made good Halloween reading. Of course, among those weird characters was the title character. Some funny moments, of course, and overall, a pretty good read. And from the kind and generous Sir Martin of Grey, I received Son of Vulcan, number 1, from 2005. This is a new Vulcan character, from what I can tell, and he unofficially adopts a kid as his sidekick, and then promptly dies in battle. Not a bad setup for a series, I have to be honest. And Batman Confidential, number 1, from 2007. I love getting books from Martin because they tend to be right in this time frame where I was getting back into comics, but not the comics of that day. So 1995, really up to 2010, is a pretty big blind spot for me reading-wise. I don't necessarily like this version of Batman, and I'm not sure if that's the story or the art or probably both. I tend to be open-minded about the various versions of Batman that I enjoy. I'm pretty open-minded, like I said, but this particular take by Andy Diggle and Wils Portacio, not my favorite. And he also sent one of those big old British reprint mags, Superman Monthly, number 33, which included a reprint of an all-time favorite story of mine, the John Byrne retelling of Superman's relationship with his one true love. L.L. No, not that L.L. Or even that other L.L. And certainly no, not that L.L. I mean, of course, Laurie Lamaris. It's a great story, a great issue. And this also included the start of the Justice League International. And at about 15% bigger than a traditional comic, some of the art really does jump off the page. Really enjoyed this one. And from Nathaniel Wayne of the Council of Geeks, I read one of the books that he found in the one and only quarter bin in all of New England, Legends number 4. You know that old saying about if you're only going to read one issue of a 6-issue mini, make sure that you read issue 4? No? Of course not. Nobody says that issue 4 is always the most disposable book in a 6-issue miniseries. I personally think Nathaniel was slyly referencing, with this particular issue, his love of classic Doctor Who. Now, there wasn't any literal running down the same hallway over and over in this issue, but there was a lot of metaphorical running over and over down the same hallway. Sir Iowa's Joe sent in a parcel of books recently, including Animosity, Evolution 1 and 2. Aftershock Comics brings us this series written by Marguerite Bennett about what happens after, in one moment, every animal on Earth begins to think, and then talk, and then take revenge on humans. There aren't a lot of positive portrayals of humans, but we do get a few, which did give me a character to relate to, at least at the start. We are in the POV often of Wintermute the Wolf, who is pretty much the ruler of this new order. But the animals seem to have learned a few things from us, and a rebellion is brewing. Interesting idea, that's for sure. I've seen it in prose fiction for a decade or so, this idea of the uplift of animals. Maybe a little less than a decade, but this is the first time I've run into the concept in comics. The generous Canadian Sir Rob Lance sent some comics in earlier in the year, including Backways, number 1 from Aftershock. A girl's friend gets sucked through a mirror, and the girl runs into some nuttiness as she tries to find her. On the last page, she finds that she is in the Backway, described as all the hidden places, all the forgotten places, sewn together into a nation of our own design. This is where magic lives, where people with knacks can bend the world. Interesting idea. Pretty cool start to a series. And he also sent a British version of Strange Tales 187, featuring Doctor Strange reprints from the Ditko and Lee era. I say British because it is priced at 10p and is promoted as coming from Marvel All Color Comics, and that is color with a U. The story is Doc Strange against Baron Mordo in the Mystic Realm, and of course, since it's Steve Ditko, the Mystic Realm looks very mystic. And I'm not a huge fan of Doctor Strange in comics, except for these Ditko-drawn books. For me, the stories just aren't that great. The characters really not all that compelling. So the art has to really stand out. And Ditko's Doctor Strange art, like, really stands out. Some of the kid books that I read, some from the generous Canadian Sir Rob Lance, some from the cheap bins at World's Greatest Comics, some from Clinton Robinson, included Archie 342 to 344, Archie Andrews, Where Are You? Digest, number 40, Mickey Mouse 111, and Richie Rich Success Stories 61. The digest that Clinton sent was cool in that these digests usually collect stories from the prior couple of decades, and this digest was originally published in 1985, so some of the stories came from as early as the 60s, and I think a few of the one-pagers may be even older based on the art and the character designs. Good variety of stories, very enjoyable. And the Richie Rich book did one very sneaky thing. Opposite a one-page gag strip about the size, physically, the physical size of Richie's allowance, was another one-page strip about Richie's allowance and him not being able to find a vault to stash it in because all of the vaults were already stuffed with, wait, guess, Hostess Twinkies, that's right. Now that is a genius comic book layout. Just genius. All right, it is time to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll do a special segment about the thematic reading that I did during November.
In 1915, the world went to war. Nations in Europe met across muddy fields in a conflict that stretched across empires, across the world. This is in history books. John Adams' story of the First World War is found in the letters he wrote back home to his mother. John Adams' Letters from the Front podcast presents these letters 100 years after they were written. Follow John Adams' story through joining the army, training and deployment on the Western Front, through his hopes and fears, frustrations and injuries, we see the personal side of a global conflict. You can find John Adams' Personal Journey podcast every month on johnadams.org.uk/letters or on iTunes under John Adams' Letters from the Front podcast. These are his words, read by his grandchildren and narrated by his great-grandchildren.
And we're back. Around this time of year, I like to do some seasonal reading. And around this specific time of year, November, that means some more comics in observance of Veterans Day. I also wanted to give friend of the network, Luke Giaconetti, a special shout out, as he has been a promoter of the November hashtag Read War Comics effort for a number of years, I believe. Good on you, Luke. And of course, both Old School Ross and Kirk Spencer participate in that hashtag, being huge fans of war books. And props to Shag and Rob, who did a War Comics episode of Digest Cast during the month as well. Now, first up, from the batch of comics and then a while back by the generous Canadian Sir Rob Lance. A lot of these that come from Rob are falling apart. That's sort of his specialty. And that is also pretty awesome. From that pack, we've got Sergeant Rock, 304. Rock and a comrade are facing execution in Italy. But Easy Company pulls the old knock out the firing squad and take their place trick. Freeing Sarge, That one also has a family drama element for one member of EZ. Interesting, good, nuanced story. And War, number 9. On the cover, this says it's from Modern Comics, but I'm guessing that might be the Canadian imprint of Charlton. This one had some one-page stories, which I hadn't seen outside of kids' books like Archie or Satsak. Those were interesting, but the lead story was the best thing in this issue. It told a story from Rome about 500 BC, Horatius at the bridge, including the entire text of the 1800s poem of that same name by Thomas Macaulay. It was an interesting mix of traditional comic with narration boxes and speech balloons, but also had the text of the poem in, you know, appropriate panels for what was being shown in the art. So it wasn't just an illustrated story or illustrated poem in this case. It was that, but it was also a comic book story. Very interesting, very intriguing way of telling a story. And Rob also sent Fightin' Marines 110 from Charlton from 1973. The best was the story of a flyboy and his trainer, and how the student exceeds the teacher, and the teacher plum doesn't like that. There was also a good story about the Battle of Midway and about the training required to be a Marine. Again, not a bad book. And from library professional Mark Sweeney from DC from 2008, I read The War That Time Forgot, number 1, the first bit of a 12-part miniseries. This one was a bunch of DC war heroes being plucked from across time and space to a mysterious, dinosaur-rific island. Firehair, Tomahawk, Johnny Cloud, Enemy Ace. Those are just a few of the characters in this title. Not a traditional war comic by any means, but a pretty fun start to a story. And from Sir Iowa's Drill, I read Eternal Warrior number 11 from Valiant from 1993. This is not a title I'm overly familiar with, but this was a really good story. A Jewish family has a valuable heirloom stolen by the Nazis in the late 30s, and in the present, those pieces are going on display at a museum. The warrior and a 1930s-era colleague go after the piece to return it to its rightful family, and a bunch of skinheads want to get it for their own nefarious purposes. I thoroughly enjoyed this one, a terrific one-off story with a real beginning, a real middle, and a real end. What more could you ask for? And from a variety of sources, including Rob Lance and a variety of stores, I read a bunch of issues from one of my favorite war comics ever, Blackhawk, 228, 245, 254, and 258. And even though these issues have numbers that seem pretty close to each other, like only 30 issues apart, they are in fact from 1967, 76, 82, and 83. That's because Black Hawk was canceled and revived a number of times, always picking up the numbering where it left off. I don't think that stopped until the new 52. And Blackhawks are always good stories. It's just a matter of how good they're going to be. More than once, these were stories about how old the Blackhawks were, whether they were borderline washed up or not. More than once, decades apart, was that story told. Overall, good stuff, good stories, terrific reads. And poking around the Hoopla Digital app for war books, I found a Caliber Press miniseries that told a very little-known, at least in the U.S., bit of World War II history in Winter War 1 through 4. This is about the 100-day war between Finland and the invading Soviet Union forces from late 1939 to early 1940. We are told the story of this brief war through the eyes of three Finnish soldiers who amazingly enough hold off the Soviets during the depth of winter, which is historically not Russia's best war fighting season. They inflict far more casualties on the Soviets than they suffer themselves, but as soon as the spring thaw approaches, things change. This was a terrific little series about a little known, again, to me completely unknown, bit of military history. Very good. The dollar bins at Journey Into Comics, I picked up Sergeant Rock Annual 3 and 4 from 1983 and 1984. These were both single-story Extra-Sized Issues, both written by Bob Kaniger. Art in one was by Dan Spiegel and the other was Frank Redondo. Both were really good. Annual 3 really appealed to me a lot. Rock and easy, run across a priest trying to get some orphans out of Germany, orphans whose parents have already been killed in the camps. The team gets the kids out, but there are many, many losses along the way. Annual 4 is a story of a brief camaraderie between warriors on different sides of a conflict. Interesting idea. Sergeant Rock is pretty great, and these are both very good issues. And from the Quarterbins, at World's Greatest Comics, I picked up Our Fighting Forces, number 170, starring the Losers. Nice twist in the story in terms of our heroes not having the heart to kill a female enemy. But fortunately, Ona, the girl on the team, showed up, even though they specifically told her to stay behind, because she saved the day. In Blazing Battle Tales, from Atlas, from 1975. And yes, the stories were fine, the art was professional, but the star of 70s books often is the ads, and this one fits in right there. Planet of the Apes, Super 8 films, have a monkey party for your friends, be the talk of the neighborhood, model kits for Star Trek, and again, Planet of the Apes, and Stratomatic Baseball. So this one was a nice mix of actual war stories and nostalgia. An Unknown Soldier, 265. The lead story was pretty good. The soldier investigating the killing of a general, probably by one of his own men. The Loser's story was solid, about a group of kids helping the team out. But this issue had an enemy ace story. And any issue that has an enemy ace story, that's probably going to be the best story in the issue, and this one was. And, hey, Mark Sweeney, it had the Hammer of Hell versus the Balloon Buster. So there was that, too. Overall, a very enjoyable batch of war books. I'm sure I'll read a few more over the next year or so, but I'm going to try to save as many as I can so I can read a bunch of them next November. And before we move fully away from Veterans Day and Remembrance Day, I do want to promote a great idea for supporting our troops with comic books.
Hey folks, this is Jared Albrick, aka the Yard Sale Artist, and semi-regular co-host of the Longbox Crusade podcast with Pat Sampson. Pat came to me recently with a fantastic idea on how we might get the podcast community involved in taking some action to do some good. He called this idea Comics for Courage. Comics for Courage is a concept that came to Pat after I told him the fantastic true story of when I was stationed in Iraq during my military service. While there, I received a huge care package of comic books from the awesome folks over at Wizard and Toy Fair magazines. We had so many comics, we didn't know what to do with them all. Seriously, it was over 100 pounds of comics. So me and a couple of buddies took the bounty of comics we had down to the give and take library we'd set up in our headquarters building. And you know what? Within 24 hours, all the comics were gone. The bottom line here is that throughout history, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, one thing remains a constant: soldiers love comics. It's quick, easy, fun reading that gives a soldier a taste of home and lets them escape into an amazing world of comics, even if it's just for a few minutes. So here's the best part of Comics for Courage. Pat and I aren't asking you to donate 1 cent of your money to Comics for Courage. What we would love is for you to donate your excess comics. You know, those ones that are just kind of laying around. Just drop them into a box or a big envelope and mail them over to supportourtroops.org. Their mailing address is Support Our Troops, 13617 North Florida Avenue, Tampa, Florida, 33613. Now, they will make sure that those comics get distributed to random soldier care packages, and as a person who's been on the receiving end of this, I can tell you it will mean a lot. And if you'd rather donate money than give up a single comic book, trust me, we understand about that. You can donate through their website as well. Again, that's supportourtroops.org. Just remember two things, all right? Two things. One, make sure the comics have good, clean content. No nudity or adults-only comics, please. Those are the rules for any military member receiving goods downrange. Okay, and number two, this is the fun one. Please take a picture of you with your donation stack and post it on Twitter or Facebook at Longbox Crusade, or email it to contact@longboxcrusade.com. We'd love to give you an on-air shout-out and post your pic on the longboxcrusade.com website. In summary, Pat and I over at Longbox Crusade Podcast would greatly appreciate you taking this small action to make a difference in the life of someone who is far from home defending our freedoms. Thank you for supporting the Comics for Courage initiative. That website again is supportourtroops.org. Please check it out. Throw them some comics. Make some soldiers happy. We appreciate it. Thanks again.
And we're back again. You see, here's the problem. I'm usually very good, as I hope you can tell from listening to this, about keeping track of which lovely listener sent which lovely book to me. But if too much time passes, and or I reorder the stack too many times, sometimes the yellow sticky gets a little unstuck. So for this next batch of books, I know that I purchased one of them to fill in the order, but I think that maybe Iowa's Joe sent the others? You remember our new motto, if I don't know, it's Iowa's Joe. Though it may have been someone else. But whoever sent Tomorrow's Stories 1-4 from Alan Moore's American Best Comics, thank you. I may have mentioned more than once that I'm generally not a huge fan of anthology books for a couple of reasons. One is that you're going to like some of the stories more than others. But another issue is that many anthologies have at least one to-be-continued story. So you're never really, like, caught up. There's always another issue that you need. But that was not the case with this title. Each of these four issues contained four stories from the same four characters. But all 16 of these stories were complete standalone tales, and that totally worked for me. And all of these were co-written to some extent by Alan Moore, and the man can conceptualize and write comic books. As you would expect, each of these had their own unique spin or take on the standard comic tropes. And my favorite character was the super genius kid character, Jack B. Quick, which was written with Kevin Nolan. Although the female noir character, the Cobweb, that one was pretty solid too. And from Michael Lane from the excellent Comics in the Golden Age podcast, who I think sent me some comics when he found duplicates the last time he was doing the big reorganization, I read Alpha Flight 9 and 24. I have read very few of this title over the years, and the ones I have read have been like these two, pretty disconnected, random issues. Of these two, 9 and 24, I like 24 more, which is a supersized issue that has the team calling in Shaman to join Talisman in grabbing Sasquatch's soul back from the underworld. I've not read a lot of Alpha Flight. Like I said, Shag, step away from the email machine. Like all of Marvel's mutant books, these are big blind spots for me, and I just sometimes feel like I don't know where to start, or if it's even worth a try. And from a combo of Luke Giaconetti and the Quarterbins at World's Greatest Comics, I read Marvel Comics Presents 145 and 156, both from 1994. The content of the book changed from one to the other, and the best characters, such as Morbius and Ghost Rider, appeared in the earlier issue, while the second one includes Vengeance and the New Warriors. Now, that latter one, 156, did have a decent Shang-Chi story, and that helped. But the first one, issue 145, was by far the more enjoyable read. And speaking of reading disconnected books from the same series, I did that with some books I picked up all from World's Greatest Comics. And I ended up reading World's Finest Comics, 239, 289, and 311. The guest star of the first one was Gold of the Metal Men, and I really liked the Metal Men. But yikes, this one had a whole lot of problems. I'm not trying to like talk trash about this title, but I've rarely found it to live up to the potential of what you should have when you have both Batman and Superman in a story. I never found this book either to have a real identity, like, say, Brave and the Bold did. Now, I'm talking about the goofy Bob Haney era, but at least it did have a identity. Now, of these, 289 was pretty cool. That had a scene with Batman and Superman getting really quite personal with each other, sharing some intense, again, personal details, like psychological stuff, emotional stuff. And what I liked about that was that it was, for me, one of the few times that some groundwork was laid for their friendship in a way that made sense to me, other than the same comic book company created us both pretty close to each other in the 1930s, so we're friends? This story was one of the few places that I actually saw the two of them acting like friends in the ways that adult men who respect each other and care about each other might act like friends. So a big shout out to Doug Mensch on writing that one. And by the way, issue 311 had a pre-crisis appearance by the Monitor and Lila. I mentioned earlier in the episode reading an issue of Marvel Team-Up for the Quarterbin. Well, I found in the stack a few other issues of that title that the generous Canadian Rob Lance had sent in a while back, so I read Marvel Team-Up 41 and 93 as well. The first one was the first part of the Salem Witch Trial story with the Scarlet Witch and Cotton Mather. This was one I was familiar with, but I don't know if that's because it's a classic story or because a couple of my podcasting buddies, though I can't remember specifically who, have covered that story. I know I have heard friends of mine talk about it. The second one, 93, featured Jack Russell, Werewolf by Night, and that was pretty good too. At this point, Russell was able to change into the werewolf at will, which I was not aware he could ever do. So that was a little bit of surprising, sort of a learning experience, as well as a good comic book reading experience. Soraya was Joe sent a bunch of comics in recently, including every book from Epic's Shadowline imprint. And I read the entirety of the second of those titles, Powerline 1 through 8. The whole line is about a small society of powerful beings who had lived for millennia unnoticed by humans. And in this series, we learn of an ancient battle between ancient families of these shadow dwellers. The focus here is on two young shadows, Victor and Lenore, who form an alliance, having been the victims of the tyrannical Ravenscore family. They learn that together, in proximity to each other, their powers are ultra-magnified. And they decide to become heroes to counter the questionable acts of Dr. Zero, whose issues we talked about last episode. We had a lot of storylines involving professional wrestling here, and then some modern-day pirates. The pirates were, in fact, Ravenscores, and the family feud does come to a reasonable end. This one got a little shaky toward the end, and the wrestling setting was a little weird for me. But I liked the characters and the basic overall plot structure. There are definitely cracks in this world, but the world building between this and Doc Zero is pretty interesting. And next month, I'll tackle the next of these Shadowline books. Jason Marcinet, formerly of the Comic Sans YouTube show, and currently of the brand new podcast Drawn and Paneled, sent in a care package recently, which included The Death of Hawkman 1 through 6, which was originally solicited at least for a few issues as Hawkman and Adam Strange Out of Time. Now, I'm a huge fan of Adam Strange and also like Hawkman. So I remember being intrigued by this title when it first came out a few years back. And it's pretty good. We start with a brutal attack on Ran, with all the evidence pointing at Thanagar, and Alana Strange is all in on her plans to attack Hawkman's world in revenge, swiftly and without mercy. But he and Adam Strange have uncovered a classic JLA villain who was in fact behind the attack, which was the start of a planned series. So the question is, can Adam convince Alana of the truth, and will she be able to see his siding with his old buddy Katar Hall as anything but treason towards Ran? There is a lot going on in these issues, and I like that. They did a good job with this, and the story, I think, holds together quite well. I enjoyed this one a lot. From the Hoopla digital app, I wrapped up a series I talked about last episode, knocking out Gotham City Sirens 20 through 26. I liked the way this series ended, I have to admit. There was a return to form for the lead characters, Catwoman, Harley, and Ivy, in terms of seeing just how fragile this three-way friendship is. The cracks in that foundation show as each of the three ladies find their priorities at odds with each other. Catwoman refuses to give up Batman's secret identity, and that is the last straw for Ivy. And when Harley falls back under the sway of Mr. J, everything is going back to the status quo. And this pretty fun series, this pretty fun team-up, goes the way of all things. I like that the ending of the series, but also of the relationships, made sense. All of the plotting and storytelling seemed like a reasonable lead-in to the eventual end. And that's all that I ask for in an ending, that it makes sense. And this one did, and it was satisfying. And another series I found on Hoopla was the first volume of Titan Comics' River of London series, Bodywork 1 through 5. This was just your standard, run-of-the-mill, vengeance-seeking, haunted automobile story. In this one, the small branch of London's weird crime investigation bureau becomes involved in a string of odd murder cases. Peter Grant has some mild wizardly powers, and along with some solid, more traditional police work, his team is able to solve the case. I liked the mystery, I liked the solution, which seemed, reasonable or realistic are not the words that you use in these stories, but it was, again, satisfying. An object with a violent past becomes sort of haunted, and then what happens after that? Well, again, it makes as much sense as you can ask from a supernatural story. I do like that all the police officers, whether they had strange powers or not, actually followed established police procedures. I really like that. I enjoyed this storyline and imagine I will eventually pick up a few more stories from the Rivers of London series. And more Rebirth. And Hoopla is always a few trades behind, but I did get a little bit caught up with Detective Comics, reading 963 through 974 and Annual 1. The first couple of these issues were a crossover that I didn't have much context for, with Mr. Oz and a future version of Tim Drake trying to talk the present version of Tim Drake that he has to kill Batwoman to keep bad things from happening in the future. I far preferred the later storyline, in which Clayface had a major supporting role. They did sort of a Ben Grimm thing with him, where there was a potential cure for him, but he would have to stay Clayface for longer than he was comfortable with in order for that to take effect, and then the lines between he and Basil Carlo were becoming blurred. I've really enjoyed having Clayface on the team, his presence, and I'm really glad that they gave him this storyline. The Annual tells a great Clayface story as well. In some of the later issues, we get the return of Red Robin, coming back to work and coming back to romance spoiler, a.k.a. Stephanie Brown. And James Tynion in the IV brings back the first victim and the victim syndicate from the very early days of his run. I like that. When a story you thought was over a year or two ago, when the consequences of those actions in that story come back to haunt the protagonists. Now, I've never been a big fan of Azrael, who's on this team, but most everyone else is a favorite of mine, and I continue to enjoy this title again, other than that Mr. Oz crossover. And more of my Hoopla Archie finds were more seasonal collections, Pep Digital 24, Fall Fun, and Pep Digital 185, Thanksgiving Feast. What I like about these collections is that there are so many Archie stories that have been told over the years. You can gather them and arrange them and order them and curate them in so many different ways with so many different themes. So last month I did Halloween, so this month a generic fall collection seemed right, as well as the more specific Thanksgiving collection. Spoilers, but next month is going to be Christmas. In these collections, we get a lot of back-to-school stories, some football stories, Thanksgiving feasts, and a pretty wide range of other tales. There always seems to be a fall festival happening somewhere in Riverdale. And it's pretty amazing how many stories there are out there over the years, over the decades, that involve the Archie gang and their raking of leaves. But if you've published comics for more than 3/4 of a century, you hit some of those basic premises over and over again. And at least in these selected stories, they more often than not manage to tell different things, even with those similar storylines. Lots of different characters, stories from school, from the lodges place, from the chocolate shop, from all over town. A pair of fun, well-curated collections of stories like so many of these have been. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, The Lost City Explorers got off to a good start. The Tomorrow Stories anthologies were really good. I enjoyed the Rivers of London, the Bodywork story, and some of the individual Archie stories in the Pep Digital collection. And the Pep Digital collections, those were very good. And of course, there was the Superman Monthly magazine with the Lori Lamoris reprint. That is one of my all-time faves. But in terms of best reads for the month, I'm going to stick with the theme of war books for hashtag War Comics Month. There were some very good ones, including the Poem story from War Comics. Some of the Black Hawk stories, of course, were excellent. I really enjoyed the Winter War miniseries. But the best one, I'm going to go with Sergeant Rock Annual 3, with Easy and some nuns and a priest getting orphans out of Nazi Germany. A wonderful story. As for next month, I'll be reading another series from the Shadowline saga, and I think I'm going to read the Michael Moorcock's Multiverse series from DC, and of course, some Christmas and winter stories. But rest assured, whatever I do end up reading next month, I'll talk about it here. And that next episode, which is going to be a long one, will also include my favorite books of the year and the annual listener awards. And if all goes well, that episode ought to be out right on New Year's Eve. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of the books that I mentioned, especially if you've read them. You can send that feedback via email at relativelygeeky@gmail.com or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for the episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.